Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you know about the development of one of the most influential nations in history? Many of us learned what we know about England's past in school, often in courses whose real aim was introducing us to American history. But as my guest today will remind us, the story of England is endlessly compelling, apart from the role it played in the establishment of American colonies. Historian Simon Jenkins is chairman of the National Trust, which works to preserve the buildings, coastline, and countryside of England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. His new book is called A Short History of England, The Glorious Story of a Rowdy Nation. Simon, welcome to Think.
Welcome indeed. Thank you very much.
We should start with the fact that this is a short history of England and not the UK. Why leave out Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland?
I left them out because I wanted to tell the story of England. It's very rarely told. It's a bit like telling the story of Texas as opposed to the story of the United States of America. Most histories are of Britain or of the United Kingdom. They used to be when I was a boy of the British Empire. Mm-hmm. And England always gets forgotten. Everybody claims to be a bit Scottish or a bit Irish or a bit Welsh. And people of English origin in America tend to say the same. Very few people admit to being English these days.
And you say English history is the most consistently eventful of any nation on earth.
I'm stretching a point. I'm not fully aware of other nations, but as I researched it, it was extraordinary. There was hardly a decade, if not a year, in which something interesting wasn't happening. And the nation was constantly changing, was always expanding or contracting or invading or being defeated or whatever. But something was always happening, and the culmination of it at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th, was the emergence of Great Britain, as it called itself, as the most powerful nation on earth, really. We were that for about a century before we ceded the title to you. And I just thought it was a story worth telling.
The land itself, we know from the archaeological record, has been populated for tens of thousands of years. How do you date the actual birth of England?
I dated it from the moment when people first referred to it as England, or when later historians referred to it as England, which was really when the Anglo-Saxon, and the word England comes from Angle, and they were the people from the Angle of Germany and Denmark in Europe. They were Saxons, essentially, who came over from Germany, from the Germanic tribes, and they settled the east coast of what became England. They defeated, in a series of battles, the ancient British people, who were the descendants of the Celts, really, and were colonized by the Romans. The Romans left, the Saxons arrived. They invaded, pushed the British west into Wales, Scotland, Ireland, and Cornwall, and essentially conquered and settled this country. I mean, some people now think that they were there a far longer period of time, but certainly by the 5th and 6th centuries AD, the country that we now know as England had more or less been defined, and over the next couple of centuries, Hadrian's Wall and Offa's Dyke, the boundaries of what is now England, were more or less settled then, and they have never changed ever since. I mean, England is a remarkably constant country.
What role did Christianity from the Romans and Saxon paganism play in early English history?
Well, it's a very interesting question, one to which really historians don't really know the full answer. The Anglo-Saxons were pagans. They brought paganism with them to a country which had been heavily Christianized by the Romans. And it's quite an indication of the nature of this invasion, that until the 6th century, until the arrival of Augustine of Rome, and the Scottish missionaries coming down from Iona, the country of England was essentially pagan, while the outer periphery, the Celtic periphery, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland, were still largely Christian. Nobody knows how Christian they were, whether it was just Christian missions and so on. But certainly Welsh churches date themselves from the 4th and 5th centuries, or the 5th and 6th centuries, earlier than the English churches. So there's no doubt that Christianity was alien to the ancient English people.
And of course you had early incursions as well by the Danes.
You then got the Danes later, in the 8th and 9th centuries. But the Danes were at that time again pagan. They were ferocious. I mean, they made the Saxons seem quite wimpish. But they weren't great settlers. They were great raiders rather than settlers. But they certainly settled. They settled much of Ireland, but they also settled the northeast of England. And they got right down into Wessex. They got down to King Alfred's country. before they were turned back. But they eventually, and this is again one of those things that's not often remembered, under King Canute in the 10th century, they really did. He was king of England. He was also king of Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. He was one of the great imperial warriors. He's chiefly remembered for trying to turn the sea back, which he never tried to do. But as always with these great kings, they'd managed to produce inadequate progeny, and so their empires always died with them.
You mentioned Wessex. I'm always interested in the origin of place names. Wessex, Essex, Sussex, they have to do with directions from Saxony, is that right?
They go right back to the Saxon invaders in the 5th century. Wessex was West Saxon territory. Essex was East Saxon territory. Middlesex was Middle Saxon territory. Sussex South, and so on. So it's fairly clear that these were very sort of dominant Saxon peoples who invaded the country and named it. And the old British names simply don't exist in much of England.
So when we in the States can call to mind instantly any date of early English history, it is 1066 when you have William the Conqueror come storming in, beginning this long legacy of conflict between England and France. I was surprised to read he was actually of Viking descent.
Oh, yes. I mean, the Battle of Hastings, most early histories of England are in some sense wrong. I mean, King Harold, who was the defeated king of England at the Battle of Hastings, he had absolutely no claim to the throne at all. He was a usurper almost. He was appointed, but he had no hereditary claim to the throne of England. He was indeed half Viking himself. His opponent, William of Normandy, was the direct descendant of Rollo the Dane, and they were Viking settlers in Normandy. I mean, Normandy means the land of the Northmen, the Northmen being the people from the north. He wasn't French at all. He might have spoken French, but he wasn't a Frenchman. He was very much a Viking warrior.
And he had been a relatively minor figure in Normandy. How did he set his sights on conquest in England?
Well, he felt, with some justification, that he'd been promised it by Edward the Confessor. He'd been to England. Edward the Confessor was half Norman himself. He was very comfortable with the concept of a Norman successor. And William, who was a ferocious warrior, felt he had the right to the throne of England, and it was also a very, very lucrative throne, because Normandy was, as you rightly say, a fairly minor province of France then. And he just thought he was in with the chance, and he was. He founded one of the great dynasties of history.
How did Harold try to mount his defense?
His defense at the battle, or as king?
As king.
He argued that he was Earl. He was one of the most powerful earls in England. He'd more or less ruled England under Edward the Confessor in his old age. And Edward the Confessor appears to have effectively given him the throne on his deathbed. So he had legitimacy in those terms, and the Witan, the collection of elders, anointed him as king. So he was a perfectly bona fide king, but his claim to the throne through heredity was very thin. He was in command. He was the preeminent warrior of England. He was a great warrior, undoubtedly. He was very unlucky to lose the Battle of Hastings, it has to be said.
Where did the name Edward the Confessor come from, by the way?
He was a very, very devout man. He would confess every day, and he became known as the Confessor for that reason.
How did Saxons and Vikings and Normans influence the language that would evolve into the English we speak today?
It's very interesting. I mean, the reason why I think I claim that England began with the Saxons and in a sense ended with the Saxons is that language, which I think is the most powerful telltale of a nation. The language that we speak today and you speak today is essentially the language of the Saxons. It's a Germanic language. It's got very little ancient British in it. It's got almost no ancient British in it, which is a Celtic language. It's got remarkably little, very little Viking in it. It's got very little Norman in it. It's got more Norman than anything else. But it is essentially still Anglo-Saxon, descended from Old High German. And the closest link in so many ways between England and the continent is with Germany. And I always think that one of the great ironies of the 20th century is we spent so much time fighting Germany, which is the country we have most in common with.
So after the Normans came in, they took land from the Saxons and reassigned it to Norman barons and bishops. How did that all affect the power of the church and of political institutions in England?
Well, it hugely increased the power of the church, and it removed all power from the Saxon earls and thanes, who were the landowners at the time. The Saxon political tradition was essential. I won't say it's democratic, that's stretching the point, but it was very localist. You swore loyalty to your clan chief. And when the Normans came along, they established this very strong sense of a central power. The king was absolute. Everybody owed loyalty to the king. The feudal system meant they paid their faith and duty to the king. So you had this clash between the Saxon people and the Norman aristocracy in league with the church. The church was very powerful. And William the Conqueror's real talent was to work out just how much power he distributed to his own barons and to the bishops. And he left a state that was extraordinarily potent. I mean, one of the strongest central states in Europe. It lasted forever.
So William the Conqueror dies. His son Rufus, known as Rufus, takes the reins. And Rufus understands, if I want to keep living like a king, I need substantial tax revenue.
Well, they all needed that. the medieval kings of England, it was extraordinary. They alternated between useless ones and very good ones. Mm-hmm. And Rufus was a pretty useless one. his brother probably killed him, and his brother Henry I was a rather useful one. But no, you're right. I mean, the point about the Norman kings is that they were belligerent. They were perpetually fighting, usually to try and reestablish or to retain their land in France, where the sort of the knightly tradition required you to go on campaign every summer and seize as much land and kill as many people as you possibly could. This was very expensive, and this meant that they had to raise taxes from both the church and the people. And in the course of raising taxes, the great phrase, no taxation without representation, was born. And the landed aristocracy acquired great power by being called upon constantly to give money to the king. Had the king been a peaceable person, he might have ruled absolutely. But as it was, the requirement for money, the requirement for money to go on campaigns in France, meant that they needed to cede some power, at least, to the people who were giving it to them.
How orderly was succession of the monarchy in those days? Because it seems like very often it was a cousin or a nephew, not necessarily from father to son.
It was usually from father to son, and unless there was something wrong with the son. Heredity was remarkably strong, and of course it had the great virtue of being you couldn't question it. I mean, basically, your son was regarded as everybody by everybody as being the rightful heir to the throne. So on the whole, a lot of people got killed, so often your son wasn't around to take over from you. But broadly speaking, sons or brothers succeeded.
And at what point did were women considered eligible to actually rule the country?
Well, it tended to be Matilda was the first. It tended to be because the king didn't like his son or didn't have a son and told his daughter she'd become queen. In Matilda's case, the so-called parliament just refused to accept. But no, it was only when the male heir was just too distant. And in France, it had to be a male heir. But in England, we didn't have what was called phallic law. So in some circumstances, the absence of a plausible male heir meant that a woman could succeed. And of course, the first was Elizabeth I.
Simon Jenkins is my guest. He's an author and chairman of the National Trust, which works to preserve the buildings, coastline, and countryside of England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. His new book is called A Short History of England, The Glorious Story of a Rowdy Nation. If you've got a question about English history, now's the time to ask it. We have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is author and historian Simon Jenkins. His new book is called A Short History of England, The Glorious Story of a Rowdy Nation. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Simon, so much early history of any country is dominated by the stories of men, which is, you know, reflects just the way things were hundreds of years ago. But it makes the story of Eleanor of Aquitaine especially interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about her and her early exploits during and after the Second Crusade?
She was a remarkable woman. She was basically queen in her own right of Aquitaine, and she in France, and she led her armies. These were the days when everybody was obsessed with going on crusades and with knightly valor, and you know, women occupied turrets and were rescued from dragons by knights errant and so on. And she was almost sort of the female equivalent of that. And she led her army to the crusade. She came back. She married the King of France. She didn't think much of him, but he was the King of France. The marriage wasn't a great success. She then claps eyes on this extraordinary man, Henry Plantagenet, who was quite short, very ruddy, but unbelievably, I think he was aged just about 18, and she was in her late 20s, even early 30s then, and she simply was infatuated by him, totally infatuated. All Europe was scandalized. She demanded a divorce from her husband. She married the young Henry. They sort of galloped off into the night. It was an extraordinary tale. She immediately started producing children by him. They were madly in love, if not happy. Needless to say, the marriage didn't end happily, and she eventually sided with his sons against him, Richard, John, and others. And it was a chaotic succession as a result. But it was one of the great love affairs of medieval history.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Sina in Denton. Hi, Sina.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a question from your guest. You know, as Aborigines of Australia have these stories of creation, the mythological beginnings of their ethnicity, does British Isle or England have such stories?
Not really. I mean, the nearest we get to it are the Saxon tribes of Germany, and they don't go back that far. So no, the answer is no. You can go back to the pre-English residents of the British Isles, and we call them the ancient British. They were Celts who arrived, nobody knows quite when, took over Stonehenge and monuments like that. But basically, we have very little idea of who the people were in these parts, And I think successive invasions and dilutions of the ethnic stock mean that we have a sufficiently interesting history without going back even further.
Do we know anything about why so many English people long ago believed in things like dragons? Or did they actually believe them, or were they considered symbolic even then?
Oh, no, dragons, it's a load of hokum. I think most of the dragons is a medieval invention, late medieval invention. Of a particularly ferocious beast that a brave knight has to kill for a lady.
So let's talk about Richard the Lionheart. He's got this noble-sounding nickname, and in fact, he was principally interested in England for its revenue potential once again.
He was completely useless as a king. I mean, he was essentially a Norman. He was brought up in Normandy. He was a French warrior. He was obsessed, like many people were at the time, with going on crusades to rescue the Holy Land from the infidel. And as you say, he used England as a revenue source. England was a very rich country throughout most of the Middle Ages, beginning to develop a very vigorous trade in wool. And wool was the oil of the Middle Ages. If you had a lot of wool, you were rich. Mm. But he was only in England about 3 months of his entire career, so he was not a significant figure in English history.
However, his fiscal abuse of his citizens did yield some important precedents. The people of London felt overtaxed, and they said, "Let's have a mayor to represent us."
Well, I, one of the reasons why I love taxation is the greatest aid to democracy. If you need to tax people, they'll hit back, and how? the mayoralty of London dates from those days. You had both the church, who had vast wealth and therefore were easy, so to speak, to tax, and the great barons, who since Magna Carta had flexed their muscles against the king. and then you had the growth of Parliament in the 13th century. All of these institutions were very important in later English history because they all represented power for the people, or representatives of the people, over against the monarchy. And the monarchy and the people had this sort of this balance of power, which in England was a very vigorous one. Neither side quite won right through into the 18th century.
Well, let's talk about the Magna Carta and what led to it. You write that under King John, England descended into chaos. What made him such a terrible monarch?
He was just a thoroughly bad monarch. I mean, you get good ones and you get bad ones. Mm-hmm. He was a bad one. He was appallingly behaved. Everywhere he went, he sort of raped women and executed people. And he went to Ireland and had to be removed from Ireland because he was such an appalling ruler there. He wasn't a stupid man, I don't think. He was an incompetent ruler, and everything he seemed to do turned to dust. And he enraged the barons who forced him to sign Magna Carta. I may say, no sooner did he signed it than he wrote to the Pope and said, "I want you to declare the Magna Carta anathema and rescind it." And so it was no sooner signed than it was ineffective. But it's become a great sort of iconic feature of English history.
And the Pope was right on with King John in that and said that the Magna Carta was really not a useful document and therefore opposed it. Did the Magna Carta threaten the power of the church at all?
No, it threatened the power of the king, though. Mm-hmm. The church regarded anything that threatened power as being a bad thing. And there was much in it about the rights of landowners and against expropriation, and it effectively established a council which had the power to meet independent of the king, and to an infallible pope. This was appalling.
And so it was really the first shift toward modern democracy in England.
It was certainly a shift towards the rule of law. Mm-hmm. Modern democracy didn't come until the end of the 13th century with Simon de Montfort's Parliament and the early summonsing of commoners as opposed to lords. But no, it's the most interesting period of history because it's the moment when you can sort of see the tripwire of democracy in front of a king, and the king from then on really had to. He had until Henry VIII at least. He had to listen to what people were saying always, or they wouldn't let him have any money.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Robbie on the line in Plano. Hi, Robbie.
Hi. Thank you. I have often wondered why have the British never come around to writing their constitution formally? And, you know, they talk about the constitution. Is it abstract? And they even talk about amendments to constitution. What exactly are they talking about? And why have they never bothered with it? Thank you.
Well, the answer to that question is we haven't needed to, I suppose. Some of us, like me, think we do need to now, but we haven't been put to the test in that sense. I mean, there are plenty of constitutional documents. There are various Parliament Acts, which are effectively constitutions. There's the Petition of Rights. Magna Carta is a sort of constitutional document. So there are plenty of documents, plural, that together comprise a constitutional settlement for England. And there's certainly a custom and practice which is written down, which says what the monarch can and cannot do, and what Parliament can and cannot do, and what the Prime Minister can and cannot do. So to say there's no constitution in England, there is a constitution. It isn't written down with amendments in the sense that the America's is. And of course, this makes it slightly more flexible than the American Constitution. We don't have to go to the rigmarole that America does to change it.
So when King John dies, his 9-year-old nephew, Henry III, becomes king. First of all, talk about how the setup worked when a child would be given the throne. I mean, were other people in charge until a certain age? How did that all work?
Oh, yes. I mean, there was a great knight called William Marshall who was his guardian and really sort of ruled the country in his stead. So you'd have a group of guardians who would look after the king and protect him. But the king remained the kind of symbol of power, and so whoever controlled the king was in a very important position, and certainly someone like Marshall was respected across Europe. Indeed, in many ways, England was better governed when there was a child king than when the king was trying to govern on his own.
Henry did give London its first zoo, which this is kind of an interesting side note, must have been an interesting place for early visitors. For one thing, they were asked to bring along a dog or a cat to feed the lions.
That's right, yes. Yeah, you paid your entry with food. But it didn't last very long because they kept thinking, you know, ostriches ate nails, and They had a weird idea as to what animals ate, and most of the animals died as a result. But they kept the crocodile. I think they kept the crocodile in the Thames, which was very exciting.
I can imagine for people going down there to do laundry or whatever they had to do. Yeah. So once again with Henry, when he became an adult, there was another shift back to this more French-style monarchy rather than the reforms of the Magna Carta. How did the barons' outrage at Henry's rule lead to the creation of that first parliament?
Now, hold on. We're in Henry III now, I take it.
Yes.
Forgive me.
I'm confusing my Henrys. Yes, thank you.
There were eight of them. Yeah. it was the same story as Magna Carta. You had a relatively weak king, not ruling very well. The barons complained that he wasn't speaking the English language. He was speaking Provençal. The English language, I have to say, was French then. Hmm. As far as the barons were concerned, so Henry III was really regarded as a bit of a disaster. A man called Simon de Montfort formed a parliament, summoned commoners to it. He as such, is regarded as the founder of modern parliament. In many ways, parliament's plural. But he wasn't a great success. The king's son Edward. Escaped from capture, eventually dismembered Simon de Montfort and dismembered Parliament.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Back to the phones now. We have George on the line in Dallas. Hello, George.
Hi. Chris, you have just asked the exact question I wanted to know, the effect of Simon de Montfort and his Parliament on future parliamentary development.
Was there anything else that you wanted to add to that, Simon?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, the most important thing about Simon de Montfort's parliament was that it existed. He'd summoned people. They met in Kenilworth. They had one meeting. They spent the entire time having an argument. It got absolutely nowhere. It was a typical parliament. but the fact of the matter was it existed. And when Edward I started summoning parliaments in order to raise money, he used the system of having one house with peers in it, lords in it, and one house with commoners in it. And from that moment onwards, this concept of two chambers, which you have in America, the concept of having two chambers took off. One of them sort of more democratic than the other, and it was a very significant innovation to that extent. And of course, once you've had a parliament, any trouble, people say, "Well, why didn't you summon a parliament? Let's have a parliament. Let's all talk about parliament." And it was a symbol of a sort of consent to rule by a king. And the king who tried to rule without the consent of Parliament tended to fail. And it was a very, very important concept, that. And it was a concept that underpinned, I think, the stability of England for the rest of its history.
How did the oppression of the Celts begin, and what was its primary purpose?
The one blind spot the Normans had was they were very good at making war. They were appalling at making peace. And they didn't like the fact that the Saxons had never fully conquered the Celtic half of the British Isles. England is only half the British Isles in land area. And they were perpetually at war with Welsh, Scots, and Irish. And they were trying to conquer them. They were trying to suppress them. They tried to colonize them. And both Wales and Ireland were heavily colonized by the Normans without much success. And, of course, the Celts fought back. And so there was a perpetual war along the border. Unlike the American wars with the Native Americans, it was never fully resolved. Indeed, it isn't resolved to this day. And so, one of the reasons why I wanted to write History of England is that there's a kind of political correctness about history, which is that you've got to pretend that Britain is one country when Britain is not one country; it's four countries.
How familiar is all of this history? I'm curious about your audience for this book. For me as an American, it's fantastic because it really fleshes out a lot of the things that I learned in classes over the years. But is this the sort of thing that anyone getting out of what we call high school would know?
No. I mean, I feel very strongly about this. I mean, my son studied history. I remember him in England now, everybody does the Tudors and then the Nazis. I remember he was doing an essay on interwar art. He was a student, and he said to me, "I know all about the Second World War, Dad, but was there a First World War?"
Hmm.
It was as desperate as that. And I feel very strongly, even if you don't teach history in depth, you should teach it in breadth.
Well, and it's a beautiful book. It's illustrated throughout. And talk about your decision to make sure that there were a lot of illustrations in this book and how you think they contribute to what we understand about history.
Oh, I think that's fairly crude. I attribute that to my publisher. I think two things. One is I like to use illustrations from the period. Mm-hmm. So almost all of them were contemporary with the period that I'm describing, right through to black and white photographs of the 20th century. I also just think nowadays people expect to see words illustrated. It may be a sad comment on us, but it helps bring people alive if you can see a picture of them. It breaks it up. It's quite a short book, I may say, so it makes it look a bit longer. I was very, very keen for it to be short. I didn't mm-hmm. want anyone to feel that they were having to wade through great pages of history. It's meant to race along at a pace.
Yeah, and then I imagine people read it and get excited about something and go off and find other books.
I hope so.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Julie on the line in Dallas. Hey, Julie.
Hi. Yes, my question is this. I understand how today our language is firmly rooted in the Anglo-Saxon, but are there any parts of our modern language today or any language domains where you find relics of the ancient English or Celt? That's my question. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
The pre-English, you mean?
I think that's what she's talking about.
Yes. No, I mean, very little. I mean, there's a great subject now called linguistic archaeology in which people try and tell the story of the world through language. It's a very, very fascinating topic. But no, I mean, very little of the English language, as you and I are speaking it today, has any trace of ancient British in it, which is a language my father knew, which is Welsh, or for that matter Irish or Gaelic and Scottish, or Cornish or Manx or Breton, all these old Celtic languages. It appears to be the case that the Saxon language swamped all preceding languages in the boundaries of England itself. So much so that people wonder if they ever spoke British in parts of eastern England. But it's certainly a very distinctive language. It derives largely from Anglo-Saxon, it's a Germanic language, with quite a lot of Latin, French roots in it, which came through the Normans. I'm sure if you break up English, you'll find half the words are Saxon and half the words are Norman. But it's part of the charm of the language.
Simon Jenkins is here. He's author of the new book, A Short History of England, The Glorious Story of a Rowdy Nation. We have lines open to take your calls now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Simon Jenkins. He is author of the new book, A Short History of England, The Glorious Story of a Rowdy Nation. If you've got a question, call it in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We should say, perhaps this is my fault, we've got about 16 minutes left and we've got about 700 years of history, so we will be skipping around in this final segment. I hope people will forgive that. We have a question here from Ed, who writes, my friend the late Christopher Hill wrote about the Norman yoke, and Tom Paine incorporated the idea in Common Sense in 1776, describing William I as a French bastard landing with his armed banditti and establishing himself King of England. Where and at whose instance, in your view, did the idea of the Norman yoke develop?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, it was essentially, a Victorian invention. Queen Victoria married a German, Prince Albert, and they were very keen to establish the ethnic roots of England in Germany, as opposed to France, which was a rather unpopular country in England. So you had this very strong concept of the Anglo-Saxons being essentially sort of proto-democrats, and they were oppressed by the Norman conquest right through into the Tudor period. It wasn't until the Tudors came to power in the 16th century that people felt that sort of England had really reasserted itself, although the Tudors were partly Welsh. So all this tends to be pretty nonsensical because everyone's got their sort of agenda they're trying to push. The Norman yoke was undoubtedly a yoke. There's no question about it. It was a conquest, and it's a conquest that lasted hundreds of years as a conquest. It really wasn't until the 15th century that the court even spoke English. So it took some time for the Norman yoke to be pushed off, in a sense. But I mean, England was, on the whole, a pretty well governed country compared to most countries in Europe at the time. So it was a mixed blessing.
You know, given those centuries of conflict with France, you write that there may have been an advantage to the extent that, you know, English leaders needed the consent to rule the people in order to get the money they needed to fight France.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That, in a nutshell, that's it. Mm-hmm. And that applied right through to the until Henry VII, Henry VIII, until the Tudors came to power.
Let's talk about Henry VIII, because we remember him in this country for his troubled marriages. But this allowed wealth to be shifted by him from the church to himself, and ultimately some of that money funneled down to form a middle class for the first time.
Yes, and there were two huge revolutions in England, and we got our revolutions out of the way early, thank goodness. One was in the 16th century with Henry VIII and his Reformation, which was a very long, drawn-out Reformation. But the dissolution of the monasteries, which was his great act in 1536, meant that a vast amount of power was removed almost overnight from the church, and it had to be given to someone. Much of it went to the king. But a great deal of it went to a new merchant class who were able to buy monastic lands and monastic property, monastic wealth and so on, were able to buy it, and in doing so bought themselves great status, bought themselves the wealth in itself, but also tended to buy themselves seats in Parliament and bought themselves political power. So by the time Henry VIII, who was basically a dictator, a real tyrant, but by the time he'd come to the end of his reign, you had in England a solid body of gentry and aristocracy, who were ready in the 17th century when the Stuarts came to power and once again behaved as unconsensual monarchs. You had a parliament in place that was capable of standing up to the king and overthrowing him.
Is it possible to point to sort of a cultural genesis for the desire to have an empire?
It's very difficult. It was always said that we acquired it in a fit of absence of mind, and I think that's partly true. A lot of it emerged in the course of the 18th century because of Britain's trading dominance being challenged by France and Spain, and it was almost a backwash of wars in Europe, wars of the Spanish Succession and so on, that led England to beat France abroad, and as a result acquire territory, which we then expanded inland. I mean, most of the early empire were trading posts around India, Southeast Asia, and America. And it was only with the growth of trade that it became more than a few trading posts and an empire. I mean, India being the classic case, and Canada being another. And it was from Canada that Britain expanded down the Mississippi and produced a situation in which we legitimately felt that North America was British.
Jumping back in history, as I warned we might do, what sparked the Hundred Years' War?
Oh, that was going back a long way.
Yeah.
The Hundred Years' War was basically the result of the Norman kings of England, the Plantagenet kings of England, as they were known, refusing to give up their what they regarded as their ancestral territories in France. And the French king, feeling this was intolerable, And the war was the British behaved at their very worst. I mean, they were just constantly, the English that they then were, they were just constantly going over to France every summer, most summers, and behaving like bandits. I mean, just going around putting towns to fire and the sword, reasserting their sovereignty over Normandy, Brittany, Aquitaine, and so on, Gascony, and then usually getting beaten back. Largely by disease. They just couldn't, it was very difficult to keep an army in France at the time. And this went on for decade after decade after decade, and in the end the French beat us out.
And it should have been clear, do you think, to the English from the beginning that this was an unwinnable war?
There was tremendous unpopularity, and the parliaments were never summoned, were always against the war, because it was very expensive, and the only beneficiary from it was usually the monarch. So yes, I mean, all one can say is that these remained Norman people. These were Plantagenet monarchs who believed their roots were in France. They believed that France was their sort of ancestral home. It was quite wrong for the King of France to try and seize these territories from them. But it was also somewhere just to fight. They loved fighting. They were obsessional fighters. So they it's almost as if they were going. I feel sometimes a bit like the 20th century. It's almost as if they were going around the world looking for someone to be an enemy.
You talked about the effect of disease during the Hundred Years' War. Talk about the outbreak of plague in 1348 and the impact it had on really the power, not only of politics but also the church in England.
My view is it was overstated. I mean, it killed between a quarter and a third of the population, and people kept on saying, were they all sinful? Was it this God's punishment, or why did God inflict this on the righteous and the unrighteous alike? There was a lot of talk about it decimating the population, and therefore it increased wages and increased labor mobility, and therefore produced the peasants' revolt. I think the view of modern historians is that it was a catastrophe, but it had remarkably little impact on the social and economic life of England.
Hmm. Was it, though, the beginning of the end of the feudal system?
The feudal system, I mean, I'm only as good as the historians I read. I mean, the general view of the feudal system was coming to an end anyway, with greater prosperity and greater trade. The wool business, which was the dominant industry of Britain at the time, was not effective. It was not really suited to the feudal system. Feudal ties were loosening anyway. Certainly, huge numbers of peasants died, but then so did their masters. There was quite a dramatic increase in land exchange, which again was eroded the feudal system. But it was going anyway.
Talk about the challenges of really understanding history when you had a small segment of the population that was literate, but that also had a desire to record things to reflect their particular view of reality, and then vast numbers of people who would never leave any written documents whatsoever.
Well, I think, I mean, the book I've written is essentially a book about politics. Mm-hmm. It's about how the country was run, who was powerful, how the people in power behaved. It's about the battles, the events, the kings. You might call it an old-fashioned history in that sense. But it's the framework of history. Without if you don't understand the dates and the great events, I think the history of the poor, or the history of women, or slavery, all these what I call newly fashionable histories, which are perfectly legitimate, but they have to hang on something, and they have to hang on the skeleton that is the politics of the country, because the political life of the country set the tone for it. It ensured that Britain, in particular, was peaceful. And it was because Britain was peaceful that it was able to develop an empire, and it was through the empire that it became a world power. So all these things matter, but they matter because the politics was right. And when the politics went wrong, as relatively rarely it did in England's history, then the country suffered.
What sort of changes were there in the psyche of the English people as the empire fell away?
I hesitate to say we took it in our stride.
You're known for that, though, stiff upper lip and everything.
I don't know. I mean, it was inevitable. I mean, it was no way you were going to keep India as a part of the British Empire after the Second World War.
Right.
The Americans, I mean, Roosevelt simply forbade it. He said, we'll help you, but you're going to... He said quite explicit to Churchill. I mean, Churchill was outraged. He said, if you want our help fighting in Europe, we're not going to help you keep an empire. And that was very, very explicit. It's not often known. But I think the dismantling of the empire, which was done, it wasn't altogether creditable, but at least it was done, I think left Britain floundering for a while, and one might even argue we still are floundering, as we still behave occasionally like a post-imperial power. But then so does America, dare I say it. I think all countries, all ex-imperial countries, are Russia for that matter, they're not at peace with the world at the moment, and I think a lot of that is something you can understand if you read history.
Well, I think a lot of Americans are interested in British history for exactly the reasons of the British Empire, because, you know, people are wondering how long American dominance will last and where we go from here.
Well, I think that's a perfectly fair question, and Britain had these two great traumas in the 20th century, the First World War and the Second World War. And they did far more than challenge the British Empire. They led people to wonder, you know, what is a nation state? How far should we go in with the other states of Europe and the European Union? We're now having serious questions asked about the United Kingdom itself. Ireland is already gone. Scotland is becoming ever more detached from England. Even dear old Wales is becoming more and more conscious of its identity. And I think what's happening is a lot of countries, countries across Europe are splintering. Yugoslavia is dividing up. Czechoslovakia divided up. I think a lot of these countries are looking on themselves and thinking, well, we're happy to be parts of great confederations, but we also want our own identity and we want to keep it. And I feel that way about England at the moment.
How important is it ultimately to England that so much of the world speaks English today in terms of the power you wield in the world?
I don't think it's about power. I think it's certainly about pride. It's certainly about tourism. I mean, people pour through London to see plays and the English publishing system, the English press, English broadcasting. We rely on the fact that half the world speaks English in some sense. But then you could say the same of America. I think many English people don't quite know why it is that English is such a widely spoken language. They assume it's something to do with America. I think it is.
Is there anything at this stage in your career that surprised you in putting together this book?
I don't think so. I don't quite know what you mean. I mean, I wasn't a historian. I always felt. I mean, I think for most people, my history was what I call tableau history. It's a series of events. You know about the Hundred Years' War or Henry VIII's wives or the British Empire or the Second World War. You were never told why they linked together. Mm-hmm. I mean, how the one thing led to the other. And I was terribly keen to try and tell the story as a narrative, so that the things that I studied I did architectural history and subjects like that, but history was always it's a sort of a backdrop on the stage in which nothing moved. And I wanted to try and make all the things move so they related to each other.
Was it hard to decide what to leave out?
It was very hard. History is fascinating. It's like books on the American Civil War. I mean, you know, it didn't go on for very long. It was just one war, but there are whole libraries of books on it. Every time you scratch the surface, you find out something else, and that's the great danger of history. You go too deep. But for me, I tried to tell it as a newspaper article, almost, just to start at the beginning, go through to the end, and then see what it is. And I was desperate to keep it down to 50,000 words, which is quite a short book. I think it's about 55.
Simon Jenkins is author of the new book, A Short History of England, The Glorious Story of a Rowdy Nation. Simon, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. You can email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.